From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Russia taking Ukraine's last Navy bases in Crimea. Egypt sentences 529 Morsi supporters to death. A look at terrorism around the world.
They want to kill each other. And I'm not sure there's a whole lot that Barack Obama or any American president can do to change that.
And scientists consider how many smells we can smell. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Russian forces have taken over one of Ukraine's last Navy bases in Crimea as Moscow consolidates control of the annexed peninsula. Kiev has ordered its remaining military in Crimea to withdraw. VOA's Daniel Scharf reports from Crimea.
Russian troops early Monday stormed Ukraine's Feodosia Navy base in Crimea with warning shots and stun grenades. Ukrainian Navy officers had been negotiating with the Russian side for an orderly withdrawal from the base, but had not received orders from Kiev. Those orders came hours later when Ukraine called for all its remaining military in Crimea to withdraw to the mainland. Navy officers Sunday had told Reuters TV they would defend the base to the end and that Russian military promised they would be allowed to leave with honor. Ukraine Navy Captain Oleksandr Lantuk said they did not want to turn over armaments and ships to the Russians.
Личный состав батальона не видит никаких причин, почему мы должны здесь оставлять нашу технику, наше оружие.
He says they do not see any reason why they should leave their vessels and weapons. They are soldiers and are responsible for them. The Navy base was one of the few left in Crimea remaining under the Ukrainian flag. Russian troops, local militia, and pro-Russia mobs this month surrounded and took over many of Ukraine's military bases in Crimea, seizing ships and weapons. Russian troops Saturday stormed two Ukrainian naval bases in Sevastopol and Novofedorovka and took control of a submarine and flagship. They used armored personnel carriers to break down a wall and gate at Ukraine's largest military holdout, Belbek Air Force Base. One Ukrainian sailor was reported injured. Ukrainian Navy Lieutenant Anatoly Mazgovoy on Sunday at Feodosia acknowledged Russia was now in control.
Планы части. Ну, видите, что произошло с Крымом. Вот, на данный момент,
the plan for the base, he asks. You can see what has happened with Crimea, he says. Currently, the situation is de facto. The aggressive moves follow a controversial March 16th referendum in Crimea that saw the vast majority there vote to become part of Russia. Moscow on Friday passed legislation making Crimea officially a part of the Russian Federation. Ukraine, the European Union, and United States condemned the vote as an illegal and illegitimate land grab. Moscow says its actions were necessary to protect ethnic Russians from alleged persecution by Kiev's interim government, which it calls fascist and anti-Russian. The tensions over Crimea are the worst between Russia and Western nations since the end of the Cold War. Western nations warned Russia against further moves on eastern Ukraine, where pro-Russia populations are calling for similar referendums. Russian military has built up and held recent drills along the border with Ukraine, raising concerns about further incursions. Crimea's Prime Minister Sergei Aksyonov on Sunday called for Russians in Ukraine to fight against the pro-Western government in Kiev. In a televised speech and in Facebook and Twitter comments, he said southeastern Ukraine's future was a close union with the Russian Federation. Ukraine's Kremlin-leaning president, Viktor Yanukovych, fled Ukraine to Russia and was voted out of office after months of street protests in Kiev turned violent. The protests were sparked when Yanukovych abruptly pulled out of a trade deal with the European Union in favor of closer ties with Russia. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Simferopol, Crimea.
For some analysis of the Crimean referendum, in which a majority of Crimeans said they wanted to become a part of Russia, and the subsequent annexation of Crimea by Moscow, VOA's Carol Castiel spoke with Joshua Tucker, professor of politics and Slavic and Russian studies at New York University. She asked him what factors played in President Putin's push to annex Crimea. He said there were several diverse factors.
I think the simplest way to start thinking about distinctions here is whether Putin is generally being driven here by international concerns or security concerns, or Putin has been driven primarily by domestic politics concerns in Russia. The simplest to start with is the security concerns. One way of looking at this, and one way that people have posited, is that in the aftermath of the Euromaidan protests, which led to the Ukrainian president, Viktor Yanukovych, fleeing the country, that the Russians looked at this situation and saw a genuine security threat, and in particular were worried either maybe very specifically about about the fate of the Black Sea Fleet and Russia's continued access to the Black Sea, or maybe more generally about what the long-term ramifications would look like of Russia losing an ally right on its border. And then wondering, if Russia does nothing about this, what message does this send in the future? So that's sort of one security concern way of looking at it. The other way that people have been throwing out and talking about is whether or not this is part of a larger movement on the part of Putin, trying to think about Russia's future and Russia's place in the world. Now, a lot of people who are subscribing to what could be loosely called the Greater Russia approach to Putin's thinking point to a 2005 speech that Putin made where he called— the language is a little bit in dispute, but where he essentially referred to the breakup of the Soviet Union as one of the great tragedies of the 21st century. If you take this vantage point, then you have a picture of Putin who sort of, as leader, is motivated perhaps for his legacy, perhaps for believing that this is what is in long-term Russia's security interests, in the idea that Putin wants to, in some way, shape, or form, restore Russia to its prior greatness. Now, I don't think many people think that this involves a full-scale reconstitution of the former Soviet Union. However, people have suggested that what this may mean is that when opportunities present themselves in order to address the situation, especially if places where there are large numbers of Russians living, Putin will take the opportunity because he sees this in sort of Russia's long-term interests.
You talked about he takes advantage of opportunities that present themselves. At the same time, he himself manufactures situations. For example, he actually fomented much of the trouble in Crimea, not to say that there weren't Russian speakers who were obviously interested in going back, so to speak, to Russia. But how do you view that? And what about the aftermath of what we just saw? Is the annexing of Crimea the last step or the first step on a slippery slope whereby Russia is going to be interested in eastern Ukraine? Because Ukraine, some analysts have said, is very personal to Putin. It's really something that he has always considered part of sort of greater Russia. So this is really a battleground.
Well, honestly, I don't know the answer to that question, and I'm not going to pretend to know the answer to the question. But I think that's why it's useful to begin thinking through these things in terms of what we think the ultimate motivation is. If the ultimate motivation was really about a fear, a security concern, after the change of government in Ukraine revolving around the Black Sea Fleet, that's something that can be assuaged, right? There, one might think that there are ways, and that may or may not include Crimea joining Russia, but there are ways that Russia's interests could be mollified in that particular regard.
I just want to interrupt briefly because this leads me to ask you, again, we saw in the referendum there was an either-or, either Crimea becomes part of Russia or it goes back to some kind of 1992 constitution. There was never an option to remain within Ukraine. And President Obama, European leaders criticized Putin for not talking, trying to dialogue with the government, but he, of course, considers this government a renegade government in Ukraine. He doesn't see their legitimacy. At the same time, now, after this referendum, Russia is forced to talk with Ukraine because Crimea is dependent on Ukraine for water, electricity, a number of things. So whether he likes it or not, there's going to have to be dialogue. And what I'm getting to is the fact that had he talked to the leaders, presumably they could have worked out a modus vivendi. Again, this goes back to what I've heard analysts say is that for Vladimir Putin, there is no such thing as a win-win situation. It's either, you know, I win, you lose, or you lose and I win.
Again, I mean, I think this is all ongoing and happening so quickly, it's presumptuous for anyone to explain what the actual thinking is on the part of Putin. What I would say, though, is, again, it's helpful to have these frames of references, right? If this is about a greater Russia strategy, where the idea is that Putin, over the course of his remaining time in power, would like to repatriate as much territory from the old former Soviet Union as he can get away with into Russia, then that suggests one set of outcomes. If, on the other hand, it's about a security concern, then I think we have to wonder, you know, from Putin's position, what did he see as the best strategy for enhancing his security in this particular area?
And that was taking Crimea and not even trusting that this interim government, which he considers illegitimate, would take his interests into consideration.
Well, clearly at this point, it looks like what the Russians wanted was, before they got into any discussions with anybody, is to have in their hip pocket this vote with overwhelming support for the first option on the referendum, the decision to reunite with Russia. But there still may absolutely be the possibility that this is part of a calculated negotiated strategy.
Joshua Tucker is a professor of politics and Slavic and Russian studies at New York University. You can hear more of his conversation with VOA's Carol Castiel by going to our website, at voanews.com and look for Press Conference USA under the Programs tab.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
In what is being called the biggest capital punishment verdict by Egypt's judiciary, 529 supporters of ousted President Mohamed Morsi have been sentenced to death. VOA's Elizabeth Ehret reports from Cairo. The hasty decision threatens to further deepen Egypt's political divide.
The condemned were convicted of killing a policeman, attacking others, and destroying property. The sentencing came after just two court sessions and before the defendants' lawyers say they were permitted to make their case. The majority was condemned in absentia, with fewer than 200 of those on trial in court. 16 suspects were acquitted. An appeal is permitted, and given the rushed circumstances of the trial, human rights and legal experts believe the verdict is unlikely to stand. Even members of the government-linked National Council for Human Rights condemned the verdict. Member Nasser Amin wrote on Twitter, "The court ruling will be overturned as soon as the defendants demand a retrial." Other legal rights advocates described it as a disaster and a scandal. Many of those on trial were arrested during fighting in the southern province of Minya, where the trial was held, after security forces dispersed Muslim Brotherhood protest camps last August in Cairo. Hundreds, possibly more, died in the crackdown, most of them supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood and Mohamed Morsi, Egypt's first freely elected leader. Thousands of Morsi's supporters have been jailed since. Caught up in the crackdown are several journalists, including Australian journalist Peter Grest, Egyptian-Canadian Mohamed Fahmy, and Egyptian Bahar Mohamed of the Qatar-based Al Jazeera network. They're on trial in a Cairo court charged with aiding what the government considers the terrorist Muslim Brotherhood. The defendants deny the charges, saying they were simply reporting the news. Grest's brother, Mike Grest, was at the court as the trial continued Monday.
We don't believe that the prosecution will be able to present any evidence to substantiate any of their charges. And more importantly, I'm hoping that another court date gets set down sooner rather than later.
The men were arrested late last year in a case that has attracted denunciations from media rights groups and others around the world. Monday's court proceedings come as Egyptian officials say the campaign for a permanent replacement for Morsi, himself on trial in several other court cases, will begin in the coming days. Egyptian officials have put strong restrictions on media coverage, leaving Egyptian news dominated by praise of the military-backed government, in particular defense minister and widely assumed future presidential candidate General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Anger over Morsi's 1 year in power remains high among many Egyptians, who blame him and his Brotherhood supporters for their often violent exclusion from Egypt's political process and attempting to impose a narrowly based Islamist rule. Publisher and political commentator Hisham Qasim.
The Brotherhood decided to step out of the process. You know, it's them that should be asked to be inclusive.
But any attempts at bringing the group and its millions of supporters back into the political fold will likely be harder after Monday's verdicts. Elizabeth Arendt, VOA News, Cairo.
Foreign ministers from across the Arab world will hold the 25th Arab League Summit, which begins Tuesday in Kuwait. Philip Walter Wellman is following that story.
Organizers say the Arab League Summit comes at a critical time in the region, and collaboration among member states is needed to move forward. One of the most pressing issues is Syria's civil war, which has claimed around 150,000 lives, according to some estimates, and continues to fuel sectarian tensions in neighboring states. But after 3 years of fighting and futile attempts to restore peace, Rice University research fellow Christian Koltz Ulrichsen says it's unlikely the League will be able to coordinate a truce.
I think there's a feeling that, as in Libya, the Arab League was the kind of natural place to start. But I think with the Arab countries themselves divided over whom to support and what extent, that has also made it much more difficult to try and come up with a coherent position on Syria.
Kuwait is holding the League's annual summit for the first time since becoming a member in 1961. It says bridging regional divides is one of its main aims as host. The meeting is being held under the slogan Solidarity for a Better Future. Now, before the talks, Kuwait's foreign affairs minister, Sheikh Sabah al-Khaled al-Sabah, said Arab solidarity was already strengthening in many domains. The director of research and consultancy at the Dubai-based Institute for Near East and Gulf Military Analysis, Theodore Karasik, says the minister's claim is an overstatement.
The title for this year's conference is one that is completely contradictory to what's ongoing in the region. And I highly doubt that the Arab League is going to be able to put forward a final closing statement that says that the Arab League is unified, given so many divisions within the member states.
Further division came to light earlier this month when Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Bahrain withdrew their ambassadors from Qatar, accusing their Gulf neighbor, which has backed the Muslim Brotherhood, of jeopardizing regional security.
I'm curious, and I think a lot of other people will be curious about if the issue of Qatar and this dispute between Doha and Riyadh and Cairo and the Emirates comes to the forefront of the Arab League meeting. And I think that will be quite telling of the impact of this squabble within the region.
Analysts like Karasik say divisions among the Gulf states could affect the capability of the Arab League because of the financial flows supporting the organization. The Arab League was founded in 1945 to strengthen relations among member states and promote the interests of Arabs. 13 heads of state have confirmed their attendance for this year's summit. Philip Walter Wellman for VOA News, Dubai.
Is terrorism getting worse in the world? 9/11 was a wake-up call for many about the threat of extremism tactics, and many steps were taken to try to block terrorist attacks. But all these years later, are those efforts working? We asked Max Abrams with the Council on Foreign Relations if we've learned our lesson.
Well, I think that that's a fair question, but as a researcher and as someone who thinks a lot about national security issues, I would move the question slightly differently. I mean, it's true that we could look at the aggregate level, you know, the aggregate number of terrorist attacks over time, and then we could try to determine whether terrorism measured in that way is going up. And if we were to do that, I think that we would find that, yes, terrorism internationally seems to be increasing. However, that would be a little bit misleading to say, or even to investigate terrorism's trajectory in that fashion. And that's because the terrorism threat isn't distributed equally throughout the world. Terrorism tends to strike certain target countries in particular. And so, to be more specific, the lion's share of terrorist attacks, the vast majority of them, they happen in countries like Pakistan, Iraq, Afghanistan, Syria, India, Nigeria, Somalia, Yemen, and Thailand. And so these are countries that perennially have a serious terrorism threat. The terrorism threat to the United States, though, I would say is actually going down. And so even though the overall number of terrorist attacks might be on the rise, Americans, at least to the extent that they stay at home, are probably safer from the terrorism threat than they have been in the past.
In these targeted nations you mentioned, why has the terrorism issue gotten worse there?
Well, that's a very good question. I think that there are a number of different reasons. One of them has to do with counterterrorism successes. After 9/11, as you know, the United States went into Afghanistan and took out a large part of the al-Qaeda leadership. The al-Qaeda threat then metastasized all over the world, whereas before they were based safely. They had a safe haven in Afghanistan with training camps and tens of thousands of members there. After we went in there, they were forced to disperse all over the world into much smaller cells. And so for that reason, the terrorism threat has become more fractured. And we talk less about terrorist organizations than things like self-starters who are radicalizing on the internet, sometimes using al-Qaeda's Inspire magazine. Another reason why the terrorism threat is more diffuse today than before, I think, has to do with the al-Qaeda leadership itself. Whereas bin Laden was particularly interested in attacking Western targets, his successor seems to be more interested in a home game, you know, in fighting other Muslim regimes. And so it's for that reason that Al-Qaeda's interests right now are focused more on, say, Syria than they are on, say, you know, Canada or the United States. And so there are a number of reasons. I think the third reason is that there's growing sectarianism in the world, particularly in the Muslim world. And so you have all these, you know, Shia and Sunni fighters fighting each other rather than investing their energies in striking Western targets as much. What I'm basically saying is that I think that the U.S. terrorism threat has gone down, even if the overall number of terrorist incidents has gone up.
Well, we'll never be completely free of terrorism. We know that. But is there something that can be done for these target nations to help reduce the acts of terrorism?
Well, I mean, that's always the question. And I think that the United States in particular tries to take the lead on making the world, you know, a safer, more benevolent place. But in reality, I don't believe that the United States has very many options. You know, it's a little bit like the situation going on in Crimea. You know, our heart goes out to the people who are being annexed there, but there isn't a whole lot the United States can do for geopolitical reasons because that's in Putin's backyard. And I think that that U.S. presidents make the mistake when there's almost a hubris, you know, that the United States can make all of these international conflicts go away if only we cared and invested ourselves enough. But the reality is that most of these conflicts, the vast, vast majority of them, have little to do with the United States, and they're really sort of endogenous to the region. You know, the sectarian conflicts that are so rife right now in the Middle East, you know, that's not the United States' fault. And the U.S. has very few options in terms of mitigating these kinds of threats. These radicals, both the Shia and the Sunni, they want to kill each other. And I'm not sure there's a whole lot that Barack Obama or any American president can do to change that.
Max Abrams, a professor with Northeastern University in Boston, Massachusetts, and a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. $1 trillion. That is a number of scents researchers believe humans can detect through their sense of smell. And VOA's Jessica Berman reports scientists say the figure is probably a conservative estimate.
Popular and scientific literature since the 1920s has put the number of odors detectable by humans at around 10,000. But in a new study published in the journal Science, researchers at Howard Hughes Medical Institute and Rockefeller Institute in New York City calculated the number of odors detectable by humans as much, much higher. Andreas Keller was co-author of the study, which challenged volunteers to sniff scents in three tiny bottles. The researchers mixed 128 odor molecules in combinations of 10, 20, and 30 molecules. The resulting subtle odors were both pleasant, including grass and citrus, and distasteful, such as sweaty socks. Two of the bottles were an identical blend. The third bottle was altered slightly. Extrapolating from how often the volunteers could identify the different scent, the scientists calculated humans could discriminate at least 1 trillion odors. Keller believes the human nose is sensitive enough to detect more than that.
Obviously, in reality, there are many more than 128 molecules that you can mix up. And you can also mix them in mixtures of more than 30.
How does that compare to dogs, which are held up as the gold standard of scent identification? Keller says our sense of smell is probably at least as good as a canine's. Our noses are just higher than a dog's. Jessica Berman, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. And don't forget, you can listen to this program again if you care to by going to podcasts and looking for International Edition 17 UT. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.